Welcome, everyone, to episode 173 of the NBA Podcast. I'm Brian Toporek, and today we're going to continue along with our division previews. We're hitting the Southwest Division today. Before we get started, a reminder, you can follow us on Twitter, at the NBA Pod. In our bio, you can find our Twitter handles, so give us a follow as well. You can also find us on iTunes, so please subscribe, download, leave some five-star reviews. We'd love any feedback. And we're being hosted on the Almighty Baller Podcast Network, so check them out on Twitter, at Almighty Casts. Joining me today, as always, is my very stable genius of a co-host, Morten Jensen. How's it going, Mort?
Brian, it's going well. I'm just sort of puzzled about something. Do I win the title of President of the United States if I can pronounce anonymous?
I think you win if you don't have everyone who's ever worked against you turn against you.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Pretty sure that's how it works these days.
Interesting.
We also have a special guest today, Mason Ginsberg, who writes for Bourbon Street Shots. How's it going, Mace?
Pretty good. Thanks for having me on. Excited to run down the division that has didn't really think about it until someone tweeted at me the other day, but it's definitely no longer the strongest division in the NBA. I feel like it ran that way for a few years. I don't think they can call that title theirs anymore, but still should be a little competitive.
I think it's at least like every team has interesting storylines going into the season. So you've got that going for you. You're not like the Southeast, which I'm already just actively dreading to do a podcast about. But before we get underway, could you let our listeners know where they can find you on Twitter and anywhere else they can find your work?
Yeah, sure. So I write for Bourbon Street Shots, which is True Hoop Network affiliate for the Pelicans. Not writing as much as I used to, but I do, me and Shamit Dua co-host the Bourbon Street Shots podcast. We're going to pick that up on a weekly basis starting in the, starting when the season really gets going. But you can find any of my work there as well as the rest of our awesome team. And Twitter handle for that is just Bourbon Street Shots with a street abbreviated. So check it out. A lot of good talent over there at Bourbon Street Shots. Love the guys that we work with.
Very good. Yeah, give him a follow. Give them a follow. The Pelicans, I mean, let's just start with them because I think they're going to be probably like one of the most interesting teams, not only in this division, but across the league. And I think we have to start with the obvious. Anthony Davis, after DeMarcus Cousins went down, he played at an MVP caliber pace. I mean, like, he's always has, but like, he went to another level, and which is scary. And he's only, what, like 25? Like, he's just entering his prime. So Mason, what do you expect from Anthony Davis this season?
Yeah, it's a good question, and I did a preview podcast with Adam for Locked On Nuggets a couple days ago, and I almost jumped to the negatives, which I don't see it a ton as it relates to how the team finished last year versus how they're going to start this year. But I'm really interested to see how the Pelicans, Anthony Davis and Drew in particular, those two guys, can play at the torrid pace that the Pelicans were playing at ever since Cousins went down. And so, I mean, if they keep this pace up for 82 games, what's the result? How, I mean, Anthony Davis's numbers should be astronomical, but at the same time, how many minutes does he play every night? When you're playing that many possessions a game, where's the drop off? Because there has to be some. It's too long of a season. I don't think the Pelicans are a team like the Spurs or like even like at LeBron's point with the Lakers of taking games off. So, I mean, what's the residual impact of the pace the Pelicans play at if they're going to try to play at that pace for 82 games? But I mean, apart from that, I mean, it's hard to think that he's going to have any sort of drop off from how he finished last season. The pairing with him and Nico fits so well. I think Julius Randle is going to be an awesome third big for them. It's just going to be a really, really fun threesome between him, Nico, and Randle. So, very excited to see how he does in a full 82 game season with the pace and style of play that they established after Cousins went down.
Yeah, if I wasn't an egregious Philly homer, I would say the Pelicans have my favorite front court in the league now. Because as you said, like, Brow and Nico played so well together. Now you add in Julius Randle, who played really well for the Lakers last year. He was their best player. And so that's my next question. Mort, I'm going to throw this one to you. How do you see Randle fitting into that rotation? And do you think Is he going to supplant Nico in the starting lineup, or do you think he'd be better off coming off the bench and then pairing with either one of those guys?
Honestly, I don't think it matters all that much in terms of who starts at the four. AD is obviously going to play the five. Like, just off of personal preference, I would prefer Randall off the bench because he's a playmaker and he's a guy who can go coast to coast. He can sort of lead that second unit. And you would kind of prefer to pair AD with a stretch shooter in terms of Mirotić specifically. But you can mix and match, and you can do so somewhat effortlessly because, you know, Randall is not a non-shooter anymore. He's not one of those guys who has to stay around like the 5 feet mark. Like, he can stretch the court, even if it's not a three. Like, he can pop from mid-range, and he will take the occasional three. Like, on the corner, you need to guard him. So I wouldn't really be that nervous about who starts or whatever, because it will make it work. But just off of personal preference again, like, he's a great ball handler. He can pass. We know he can pass. I would love to see that off the bench and just being like the king of the second unit.
Yeah. I think what's interesting is that really all three of those guys can play either front court position. I mean, you don't want Nico out there as the five like for 30 minutes a night, but in a small ball unit, he could play that. Randall played more center than ever last year. Like, the Lakers played him predominantly a power forward the first couple seasons, but I think it was like a 60-40 split last year between the four and the five. So it almost doesn't matter. You know, I don't think they're gonna have like positional designations with those three guys. It's just gonna be like, throw two of them out there and just figure it out. But that's gonna make it really hard on defenses, because like, who's guarding fours, who's guarding fives won't matter. Like, they could have a very switchy defense, I feel like, which is going to be good luck to the other team.
Well, I actually have a question regarding that. So, you know, the Bulls played Nico at the three some. You should never really play Nico at the three. But when you look at the Pelicans specifically and their wing slot, especially their small forward position, like, is it worth it to actually trot that at lineup out of AD, Randall, and Nico at the fourth? 5, 4, and 3, just because the alternative is like Solomon Hill.
I
think it's so all the points you guys have raised have been spot on. I mean, I think Nico is the guy who starts. I mean, you pick up where you left off last season. I think that's pretty easy, and then any of those three guys can play together at the four and the five. And regarding the switchability, I think that's big, and I think that's what part of what helped the Pelicans last season. Obviously, their one glaring weakness is the lack of their wing depth. I mean, Solomon Hill, the non-existent offensive resource that he was, he still a couple years ago was very solid for them on defense. And last year, I just think he didn't get back to 100% from his hamstring injury. But history shows those tend to heal completely. Most recent example would be Chris Middleton. And so I'm not concerned about Hill getting back to where he was on defense last year. The question is whether or not he can provide anything on offense. And so the trick is, I think you will see a decent amount of minutes with those three bigs playing together. Maybe not a ton, but enough to really keep your heads above water, given that lack of wing depth. But we also saw how much Gentry likes playing the three-guard lineups together. Etuan Moore, I think, didn't get enough credit on the defensive end last year because he always ended up having to guard the three, and he's a strong defender. He's not great, but he's above average. He's definitely good enough. But it's tough when he's guarding guys 3-4 inches taller than him on a nightly basis. And so I know Drew took on more and more of those matchups in the playoffs, but in the regular season they asked Moore to do a lot of that. And so I think it'll be interesting to see either if you go Drew Moore and those three bigs, or Drew Moore Hill and two of those bigs. I think the one thing Gentry's got to be careful about, and I know we'll probably talk about the other new addition in a second, is playing Solomon Hill and Elfrid Payton together. We didn't really get to see how he would have managed that much last year because of Hill's injury. But Rondo and Hill, I'm not sure games would have worked out very well for the Pelicans if those two guys had gotten a bunch of minutes together. And so how he kind of balances those are the two biggest non-shooters. And I know Randall probably fits into that as well to a degree. But as far as backcourt goes, I don't think the Pelicans can really manage a ton of minutes with those two playing at the same time.
I would agree. I mean, could you imagine, you know, Hill and Randall and Payton on the court at the same time. I mean, you would just be able to clock the lane. Yeah, I mean, that should just be a non-starter, obviously. So where does the shooting come from?
I think that was kind of a little bit of an overplayed line last year. I mean, so the Pelicans didn't shoot the ball well down the stretch when after Cousins went out. They were actually a pretty good shooting team with Cousins on the floor. Cousins loves to take threes. We all know that. I think he shot around 35%, which is, you know, especially for a center, that's fine. And they had guys like Darius Miller step up. But the thing is, when Cousins went down, he's a guy who really took a step back. I think Cousins helped give a guy like Miller more space to shoot. And without him, he didn't shoot so well. So they're going to really need him to bounce back and give the Pelicans, you know, 15, 20 quality minutes off the bench where he can be a shooter that at least is worth defending. Another guy who the opposite was true for went at pre-post Cousins and with Nico on the team was Ian Clark. Ian Clark really took a step up after with that. The team that we ended up seeing the Pelicans finish the season with and go into the playoffs with. And so I think I'm looking forward to seeing what he can do. Getting him back on non-Bird, what I think was a kind of a sneaky big move for the Pelicans and kind of helping out their backcourt depth. Only other guy to really mention is Frank Jackson, who, if he can ever stay healthy, he had a great one half in Summer League, and he got a lot of people excited. And obviously, Summer League's not really nothing you want to project forward with. But he's shown that he's a pretty talented basketball player, and the Pelicans do have high hopes for him. But he's had injury troubles, so it will be interesting to see what they can get out of him. But yeah, I mean, overall, from a shooting perspective, I don't think the Pelicans are going to be at the top of the league. I don't think they're going to be at the bottom of the league. I think they've got enough to have about a league average 3-point percentage. But the question comes along with that is, you know, can you force teams to guard you? Because that's what really opens up the space for the rest of the guys. And that's the key, I think, to really sustaining a strong offense for this Pelicans team. Because defensively, they're sound. They've got some talent on the defensive end. It's whether or not they can be, you know, in the upper half of the league to borderline top 10 offense in a sustainable manner that will really see if this team can get close to that 50-win threshold.
Yeah. So let's actually go into, as you alluded to, the other big offseason addition was they lost Rajon Rondo, and in his place they have Elfrid Payton. I mean, you know, talking about, you were mentioning like the three-wing lineup a couple minutes ago. Payton's got 4 inches on Rondo, so I guess you could like technically just trot out him, Drew, and Etwan Moore, and you just got like three guys who are 6'4", 6'5", and they can all kind of switch on a possession-by-possession basis if needed. But as you mentioned, offense is the bigger concern with him. He's not a great shooter. He did shoot 37% or so in Orlando last year before he got traded to Phoenix, but then he shot 20% from three in Phoenix, which is not great. And just by and large, he's not a high-volume three-point shooter. So how do you see him fitting specifically with Drew? Do you think he's going to be the starting point guard and they're going to start Drew at the two again like they did with Rondo or Drew? Or do you think Drew's going to be the starting point guard and Peyton's coming off the bench to do like a run the second unit, presumably with Randall?
Yeah, so it's funny because the bigger concern for me with Payton is defense, not offense. I think I'll shout out my podcast co-host Shemet. He wrote a great article this offseason about, he calls it Gentry Ball, and basically it's looking at how players fit with Gentry's style and what he's trying to do, and it kind of all revolves around early shot frequency and early shot efficiency. So it keeps that pace up, and Elfrid Payton actually. It rates very well as a guy who would fit into Gentry's system, and he's able to get to the rim on his own. He's able to convert with a strong rate. He's obviously not a great shooter, so that's a fair knock on him. But I think as far as his offensive skill set relative to what the Pelicans are trying to do offensively, I think it fits really well. I think on defense that he's no better than Rondo. I don't think he's any worse than Rondo, but it's about the same. Yeah, maybe he has a little more size. I think Rondo's got pretty strong wingspan though for his height. So I wouldn't even call the difference there that drastic. But so defensively, that's a concern. But I think as long as you're not, you know, doubling down on the number of non-shooters along with Payton, I think offensively he fits pretty well.
Interesting. I'm excited to see him just because he's still so young. You know, he's what, he's 24, so like,
and he's had some really great franchises he's been with Magic and right. the Suns. So,
right, exactly. Like, it's, I know we're quick to give up on those guys, but, and not to say he's going to take a leap like Oladipo did last year, but like, think about our perception of Oladipo through the first 4 years of his career, and then he goes to Indiana and just has this like monster all-star season.
Yep.
Again, I'm not saying Peyton's going to have that sure. same type of development curve, but like, I'm not giving up on a 24-year-old who's shown some flashes. Like, if his jumper comes around, he'll be a totally fine, like, 10-year in the league point guard. Yeah. I think,
and he cut his hair, so now he can actually see the basket.
Yeah, and like, and sometimes I don't give much credit to, you know, players coming home or anything like that, but he's from Louisiana. He went to ULL, which is 2 hours from New Orleans for college, and yeah, you never know. Sometimes you get a little more comfortable when you get into more familiar environments, and we'll see what happens.
Yeah. Well, the only big other offseason acquisition I want to talk about before we move on, Jahlil Okafor.
Coming home. Of course you do.
Coming home to the Pelicans. I read something recently where he was like talking about Markel Fultz, and of course I hate read the entire thing, and he was just talking about, you know, like how where you get drafted and like your situation could kind of just screw you over. And he was just saying, you know, like, I have a fresh start with the Pelicans. I'm excited to like join a team that actually wants to win. I haven't been on a team like that before, to which I was just like, fuck you, Jahlil Okafor. But what do you have any hope for him at all, or do you think he's just like a fringe end of the bench guy?
So I feel incredibly confident that he's going to make the roster. That's first.
Okay.
And which is a point worth making because his contract's not guaranteed. He was at the Jay-Z Beyonce concert with AD the other night. I think those two are. I think AD is kind of in his corner, which matters. Especially as we get closer and closer to Davis's, free agency. And so, I think he'll make the team. I don't really have any expectations for him, on the team. I don't, as far as whether or not he's going to move the team's win total one way or another way, I don't see it. I know how bad teams were with him on the court, but I don't think he's going to be a guy you sign and say, oh, Pelicans just got worse. I don't think he's going to. I think they'll give him chances in kind of low risk situations and see where it goes. Because I mean, his workout videos and how slim down he looks has been one of the storylines of the off season, and so it's one of those you still got to prove it though. And so
yeah.
I don't have zero hopes for him, but I don't expect him to move the needle. I still think the Pelicans in the contract they signed him for, they gave him like maybe $50,000 or so guaranteed, and they have a team option for next season. So. It's about as low risk as you can imagine. So, with that said, I like the signing.
Yeah, it's as you said, it's low risk. I'm proud of you for not pulling like a Garpax and being like, oh, we just signed a top three pick. We're gonna get significantly better.
Signed a top 10 pick with Alfred Payton. The top three pick. Yeah. We're going places. Yeah.
So many lottery picks. How could you not win 50 games? But yeah, I mean. I'm morbidly intrigued to see what happens here, because as you said, like, I didn't know he's like that close with Anthony Davis, but I feel like just having a guy like Anthony Davis to go up against in practice, like, you're gonna have to get better, right? Or he's just gonna destroy you all year. Like, I mean, you know,
wasn't that the logic in Philly too, though?
Yeah, but like Nerlens also sucked. It didn't, and like Embiid wasn't ever healthy. So, but I think when Embiid finally got healthy, he destroyed both Nerlens and Okafor, and they were like, "Oh boy, we gotta get these guys out of here." But yeah, I'm excited to see if Skinny Ja turns into anything good. I hope he does.
You know what, Brian? I'm just realizing something regarding that. You know, the trading matchups, because Okafor could not be at a better place in terms of internal improvement. Look at that three-headed monster of a front court that he's going to go up against in practice. So you have AD, who can just go inside outside and is just, you know, flat out amazing and world beater. Then you have Nico, who's just going to stretch, so he has to like read and recover and you know, hedge and recover. And then you have a very playmaking Julius Randle, where you have to like play the pass instead of just the shot. So potentially, maybe, just having all those different reads that he has to make all the time in practice can actually improve him.
You're actually speaking to so the other big that really hasn't taken a leap like the Pelicans were hoping is Cheick Diallo, and part of the Okafor logic was also, I think, just to light a fire under his ass and say, hey, you're running out of time here. You put up some numbers, but you haven't proven that you're going to be a legitimate NBA rotation player. And so I think, you know, all those points are fair for Diallo as well, and also just to say, hey, we need to see something from you this year. We need to see a real step, or else we don't have much of a reason to invest anymore in you. And so he's got some raw skills, but he really hasn't been able to translate those to being, you know, whether you want to call it basketball IQ or just kind of being situationally aware, just to be a guy who you can count on a night in, night out basis.
Interesting. Well, suffice it to say, the Pelicans are going to be one of the more fun and interesting teams to watch, again, not just in this division, but the entire league. That said, there is, you know, another massive team that made it to Game 7 of the Western Conference Finals last year and then missed 27 three-pointers. We got to talk about the Houston Rockets, because they had, you know, they still have Chris Paul and James Harden, but they did overhaul their supporting cast a bit. So Mason, Mort and I have already talked about Carmelo, but I want to get your take on, how do you think he's going to fit in Houston this year?
I mean, I don't think the fit can be too much worse than it was in Oklahoma City. I think he'll be fine as long as you have the proper context for what you expect from him. Like, he shouldn't be playing in any closing lineups. He shouldn't. I mean, whether or not you want to start him and pull him 5 minutes into the game, I don't. You know, whatever. But he shouldn't be getting starters minutes. He should be a backup off the bench that can maybe keep your scoring for your second unit afloat. Not that they really need that, because they tend to like to play Harden or Paul during 100% of their minutes. But as far as that's concerned, at least you have now two really dangerous offensive options, the guys that can do a lot of things. Whether D'Antoni can get him to do the right things on offense, that remains to be seen. As fruitful as their Knicks tenure was together. I mean, whatever. They got him for the minimum. It's similar to it's a little more dangerous than the Okafor situation we just talked about, because Melo's guy who thinks he deserves a lot of minutes. But it feels kind of low risk to me. I don't hate the decision to bring him in.
Yeah. I mean, you're right. Like, it's a high upside move. It's also much higher risk than Okafor. But, you know, if nothing else, like, his isolation style is going to fit what D'Antoni is now running in Houston, just like running nothing but isolations, basically. And if, like, it's a matter of him buying in, as you said. It's like, if he is willing to accept the role that he is asked to play, which I don't know that he quite got there last year, he could be a really, like, people mock this signing, I think, a lot more than they should have. Like, there is some significant upside. It's not necessarily going to blow up in their face just because he had a terrible year in OKC last year. So
yeah, like, if you give him the full mid-level exception, like, that's a problem. That's what people were talking about. New Orleans should have done to keep Rondo, and it's just like, no, that would not be a smart move. And so the fact they got him for the minimum, I just have a hard time really criticizing it.
Right. Yeah. Totally agree. One of the big storylines before the whole Carmelo thing was they lost Trevor Ariza, I think, on the first day of free agency.
First thing.
And then Luke Mbamute also left. So that was, you know, there was a lot of talk about, like, oh, Houston's not going to be the second best team in the West. Those two guys are so versatile, and, like, those helped them have this defense that I believe ranked sixth in the NBA. They just had all these switchy wings.
Right.
How much do you think they are going to miss those guys, and do you think the signing of James Ennis is going to help replace them at all?
Well, I mean, they're obviously going to sign. I think NBA Twitter had a fun reaction when Ennis was signed. Like, oh, okay, they got someone who can sort of replace these guys, but you kind of overlook the fact that Ennis is not Ariza. Ariza is special. Like, there's a reason he received $15 million this year from Phoenix. Like, he is extremely switchable. He can hit a high rate of threes. He's just one of those guys who just, you can plug and play into virtually in every lineup. And that is special. So I think they are going to take a step back. What you have to look at is, how do they fill the holes you know, from a different perspective. Like, you now you have Melo, who can add that scoring punch. Like, he might not offer the 3 and D, but he will offer the 3 at the very least. And then you have Edis, who's probably more of a defender than he is like a clear-cut three-point shooter at this stage, even though he did fairly well last season, I want to say. Mm-hmm. So you have to sort of mix and match a little bit more. You have to be a little more tactical in your approach, which falls on D'Antoni. Like, he needs to figure this stuff out. And you are more than likely going to see PJ Tucker getting very extended minutes compared to last year.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's going to be interesting to see just like the lineup combinations in general. Like, you're obviously going to have Chris Paul, James Harden, Capella getting 30, 35 minutes a night. Carmelo presumably will play 25 to 30. But yeah, like, Tucker might lead the team in minutes.
Eric Gordon, my one of my favorite New Orleans players of all time, that was pure sarcasm, by the way. he's gonna have a bigger role now too. I mean, they like playing three guard lineups with him, and now he's gonna they're gonna need more from him on the wing than they did last year.
Definitely, yeah. Not only was the Melo signing mocked a lot, but I saw some surprising backlash to the trade. You know, Ryan Anderson and D'Anthony Melton for Brandon Knight and Marquese Chris. I think a lot of that is because basketball Twitter is very analytically minded. D'Anthony Melton graded out very well in like pre-draft analytic models. There's a lot of talk about like, well, they probably just gave up the best player in that trade and it's D'Anthony Melton. That said, I don't know. I'm kind of high on the move for Houston too. Like, I don't think I know Brandon Knight hurt, or he's been hurt a lot the last couple of years, and we just don't know what to expect from him. But like, before all of these injuries, he was fine. Like, you don't want him as a 35 minute per game point guard, but they're not going to have that because they have Chris Paul and James Harden. Like, he strikes me as a totally fine six man off the bench. And then I saw comments from Daryl Morey recently where he seems really high on Marquese Chris too. So Mace, do you have any idea what to expect from those guys this year?
Yeah, I had the same reaction to you when I saw how people were taking that trade. It's just, I mean, I get the whole, Melton graded out well, but, like, the dude was a mid-second-round pick for a reason. Like, I'm not going to – you can't just look at NBA Summer League and say that a bunch of teams, you know, missed on him. And I think, you know, like I said, if he has a very good chance of being a good player. I just think people are assuming too much too soon with him. And so with that being said, I mean, I think the Rockets made a fine trade. I think – it made a lot of sense for them. They got out of a decent amount of money, and I don't think... Mm-hmm. And even with Melton, he's not a guy who I think was going to help the Rockets this season anyway. Very few rookies make a sizable positive impact in their rookie year anyway, much less second-round picks. So, I don't really have high hopes for Chris, but I mean, I think he... Similar to Elfrid Payton, you know? If he's in a different situation... who knows what D'Antoni can get out of him. And I think, at least I think the fit is a little better. So, I think the trade made sense for Houston. I don't really have a problem with it. I don't think it moves the needle significantly in either direction for them this year, but I totally get the logic behind doing it.
Yeah. I mean, like, all you have to say is they got out of Ryan Anderson's contract without dumping a first round pick, which no one thought was possible. Like, I think, wasn't it Zach Lowe who at one point reported they were trying to dump it earlier in the year and teams were asking for 2 first-round picks? Which is, I know they took bad money back in Brandon Knight, but again, like, I don't know that he's, in terms of bad money, like, I would rather have Brandon Knight than I would Ryan Anderson. Like, Ryan Anderson proved completely unplayable in the playoffs. Brandon Knight very might well as well, but we don't know, and, like, he's good... If nothing else, he's good insurance because Chris Paul, you know, knock on wood, he'll stay healthy. But if he does, it would be the first time in a while that he's made it through a full 82-game season without getting, like, some injury that knocks him out for a couple games. So if nothing else, he's good insurance that way. And as you said, like, more, I know you're super high on Melton, so you're probably just waiting to, like, rain down fury on us. But I agree with Mason that he might be the best player in this deal overall, like, down the line, but I agree that he wasn't going to help this year. And for a Rockets team that is, like, firmly in win now mode, I mean, Chris Paul is already on the wrong side of 30. He's not getting any younger.
Right.
I think the combo of Brandon Knight and Marquise Chris will help them win now more than the combo of Melton and Ryan Anderson would.
And that, yeah, that's where I disagree. I think Melton is ready. And I think he is significantly better than Marquise Chris, who I have no confidence in whatsoever. He was given every chance possible in Phoenix, and he just wasted them consistently. And in terms of Brandon Knight, you know, he just missed all of last year. The year before, he played like, 54 games and was fairly ineffective, and played, I think, 52 the year before that. So I just don't have a lot of confidence in his longevity and his durability. So I would rather have someone who's plucky and defensive-oriented, and Melton is that. I think he's a type of guy, like, I get the whole narrative. He was selected in the second round, but I will say, like, there was a large chunk of people who were just absolutely flabbergasted that he went in the second round. I had him 18th on my mock draft coming in. I was absolutely blown away that he was taken at 46. I was sitting there covering the draft and just going, what the hell are teams thinking? And a lot of people were. I think he's going to surprise a lot of people. And I wouldn't have been surprised one bit if he had been an active playoff body this year. You know this, Brian. I've said so many times that Melton, he would be guarding, Steph Curry in the conference finals next year.
Yeah, so I think they'd get swept if that happened.
I don't necessarily agree. I think this dude is just one of those balls to the walls, hard effort players who just goes out and gives 100% every single time out. And it's one of those key guys that you need to have a championship. We'll see. I mean, look, Daryl Morey has proved my ass wrong so many times that I'm not going to sit here and say, oh, well, it is definitely a bad trade. He can absolutely prove me wrong. But from what I've seen from Marquise Chris, what I've seen from Brandon Knight over the last couple of years in terms of his durability, I'm just not super high on the deal from Houston's perspective. And considering, Phoenix took back, D'Anthony Melton, and also drafted Eli Okobo, I'm just super high on what they can do.
I think Daryl Morey is a very analytical guy, and so first he took the guy who looked like a steal by the analytics, and then he said, this guy who was a steal also had a great summer league, and his value may be greater than his actual productivity, and that may not be the case in a few years, but I think at the point in time he saw an opportunity to dump that contract and of Ryan Anderson, and he just took it.
Yeah, which I get. I mean, look, you both are absolutely right about the Anderson point. Like, he could not be on the court in the playoffs. He just got played out of the damn game. I mean, could not read or react to a pick-and-roll defense. So, absolutely. I just question whether that new bad contract is going to be healthy at that point in time. Yeah. Like, Brandon Knight, right now, I read something saying that Knight is not even certain to return at the start of the season as well. I could be wrong, but yeah, I think I read something along those lines as well.
John Gambadoro, who's a Phoenix-based reporter, says he may not be ready for the start of training camp, but he does expect to be ready for the start of the season.
Oh, okay. That's a lot better, though. Yeah,
he had a minor cleanup on his knee. He reported this at the beginning of September, so he had a minor cleanup of his knee about mid-July. That's concerning in and of itself, just based on how many knee issues he's had in recent years. So, that's totally fair. That is the concern with Brandon Knight. Less so, is he going to be productive? Because in whatever role they ask him to play, I think he will, if only because he'll probably be playing next to one of Chris Paul and James Harden, and he can play either backcourt spot. Those guys, just by nature of how good they are, will make him better. But as you said, can he make it through a full 82-game season? I don't know. Right.
I think there's more to it. Sorry to interrupt, but one thing, you and I, we actually talked about this on the podcast. Well, we saw the rumor about Ryan Anderson for Nicholas Batum, right? Going for a longer contract. Anderson had 2 years left, and where is Houston going cap-wise? They're not going to have cap space. They might as well go for someone who has a more expensive and longer contract, because why the hell not? So when you look at those rumors that popped up consistently, and it wasn't just Nick Batum, it was also James Johnson, for example, and then you get this, you get Marquise Chris and Brandon Knight, and you just go, oh, that's deflating. That's not what I was thinking. I guess I would have been excited to see the Rockets add Nick Batum. Yeah. That would have been awesome.
It's funny because we've talked about similar things with New Orleans and adding, instead of trying to like shed Solomon Hill with the first round pick and making cap space, why not just go the opposite direction? Instead of taking your chances on a free agent market that might not pan out, go get a guy who's a good player, maybe overpaid, but it can help your team and is on a longer deal. Like I'm not saying Nick Batum is the guy, but someone like that. As another option to free agency. And so it's interesting. I think Rockets were in a similar position. And so I fully expect the Pelicans to trade their first round pick at some point for a guy who can really help on the wing. And I think that specific strategy might be one that they look at.
Interesting. Before we move on, just quickly, both of you, Mace, you can go first. Do you think the Rockets, after all the offseason changes, are they still the second best team in the West this year?
Well, they were the best regular season team in the West, if we want to split hairs, because I think it's important in the sense that in the regular season, I still think they are a top two team. I'm not sure they're the second best team in the sense of, do I think they still have the best chance of all the teams in the West of beating Golden State? I'm not sure about that. But I do think, as far as the regular season is concerned, they're still probably one of the two best teams and finish up with a top two record.
Yeah, I'll echo Mace on this one because I just don't see who's going to pop up to the second seed. Like, I don't think it's the Lakers. I know you're going to say Oklahoma, Brian, because your boner has been constant for the past couple of weeks.
Roberson's out for too long, I think. That was kind of my point. Like, I think in the playoffs, OKC maybe ends up being the second best team in the West. But I think Roberson's out for too long to start the year. I don't know if they can really catch up because he was just so important to them last year.
Yeah, right. And also the Westbrook thing now.
Yeah, the Westbrook thing now. And also they need time to figure out where their offense is going to come from. Like, I agree with Brian, their defense is going to be outstanding from day one. But I think it's going to take like half a year for them to really recognize, oh, okay, this is where we're going to get those additional points. Like, they're not going to come initially. So, and I think Houston right now is just a more well-oiled machine. Mm-hmm. I mean, they're just going to fire away shots and they're going to drop because that system just works. And again, I agree with Mays. It's a different discussion in terms of the regular season than the playoffs.
Right.
I wouldn't be surprised to see Houston fall out in round two. I mean, everything could happen there. But in the regular season, I wouldn't be surprised at all, even if they, you know, are number one.
Yeah. Yeah, I think their over-under was like 54.5, I want to say, which felt at least like 4 or 5 wins too low.
Yeah, like, that was just insulting. They won 65 the year before.
Right.
I mean, Harden is not going to decline.
Yeah. I mean, if one of them get hurt, I guess. But no, I'm with you guys in thinking, like, regular season, I think they're a top two team. I don't know that they have the best chance to beat Golden State in the playoffs, but who knows what happens. Yeah. Who knows what happens once you get to the playoffs? If Golden State doesn't come in healthy, it might not matter. Like, if Steph Curry is not there, they're going to be a lot more vulnerable.
Do you think Bruno Caboclo could become a thing in Houston?
He is now 0 years away from being 0 years away.
He is
away,
zero
right?
years away so, from being there. But I mean, look, it's a team that, like you guys said, analytically driven. They might find a way to, you know, sprinkle some fairy dust on him and turn him into something useful.
Yeah, I guess it's possible. Well, we'll see.
Yeah, I'm that's one of my side plots for this year, looking over that situation.
Well, I know another one of your side plots, Mort, is the Dallas Mavericks.
Yes.
More specifically, the Luka Doncic hype train is starting to leave the station.
Yes. Yeah.
What are realistic expectations for him?
In terms of productivity, stats, or just impact?
Yeah, anything.
All right. Realistic, the best rookie in the class because he's just the most NBA ready. This entire idea that he didn't play college ball and the NCAA can take the EuroLeague, you know, with one hand tied behind his back, like, it's ridiculous. Like, he was so far above everyone else in terms of being NBA ready. And I think that's going to carry over. Harrison Barnes was on the jump the other day, and he had nothing. When Rachel Nichols asked him about Luka, like, he had nothing bad to say. He was just like, this dude is dropping dimes when we're playing. Like, he's just doing these things, and it's coming so natural to him. He knows what he's doing in every pick and roll scenario that you can even imagine. And yes, that just confirms everything we've seen over the last couple of years. So I think he's going to be the second or maybe even primary playmaker. He's going to hit threes. He's going to get a lot of assists. He's going to get, he can create his own mid-range shot whenever he wants to. I even think we're going to see some post play from him. I wouldn't be surprised at all to see him win the Rookie of the Year award. He's that good, and it wouldn't even surprise me to see him play on his a pseudo All-Star level. He's fantastic.
You had me until a pseudo All-Star.
But you know what I mean, though. I mean,
yeah.
We've had rookies over the last couple of years coming in and making like All-Star buzz noise. Like Donovan Mitchell was like an All-Star type player. Not, you know, same with Ben Simmons, even though, you know, he had a year in. But I don't see why Luka Doncic can't have a similar impact as Donovan Mitchell.
Yeah. I would think he's more, like, just in terms of, like, stylistic impact, he'll be more along the lines of Simmons than, you know. Like,
obviously, right. Yeah, influence them.
Yeah. I mean, I think Rookie of the Year, I think, are fair expectations. Like, he should enter the year as the Rookie of the Year favorite.
He won't be, but yeah.
Right, but, like, not only because he's more NBA ready than any of those guys, but the opportunity is going to be there. Like, they're going to put the ball in his hands a lot. I mean, I didn't see Harrison Barnes' comments, but I saw, like, Dirk the other day was saying he called him, like, an incredible talent and said his court vision and passing for his size at his age is something I've never seen in my 20 years.
Yeah.
Like, yep. When Dirk Nowitzki is saying that about you, it's a pretty good sign.
Yeah.
And so, I mean, I think that, among anything else, that is the story of this season for the Mavericks, is, like, this very well could be Dirk's last year. This year is the passing of the torch from, like, Dirk has been the face of this organization for 20 years. If they play their cards right, Luka Doncic is going to be the face of the organization for the next 15 to 20.
Yeah.
And he's, like, he's that good of a player. Like, he should have been the number one pick, that good of a player.
Right. I agree full out.
That said, Mason, they also have another top 10 pick in their backcourt in Dennis Smith Jr. How do you see him meshing with Luka this year?
Yeah, it's funny. We heard a ton about Dennis Smith, I feel like, in the first month or so of the season. And then things kind of set. I feel like a lot of people tend to forget about Dennis Smith as Donovan Mitchell's hype continued to increase. And it's right. I still feel like Dennis Smith had a very solid rookie campaign. And it's funny. I was just taking a quick look at sometimes ESPN's depth charts are hilarious. And what they project, and it currently has Luka behind Dennis Smith at point guard in the depth chart. I'm like, yeah, I'm pretty sure those guys are going to start together. But it's interesting. Like I was looking at this team, and like I don't know. Like I feel like I know four of the five starters pretty well. I feel like DeAndre, Harrison Barnes, Dennis Smith, and Luka. And it's like, who's the fifth starter? Like who is it? Wes Matthews? Is it? I don't think it's Dirk. It's probably not Dirk, right? So maybe they run Wes Matthews and go Harrison Barnes to the four. I don't know, but I think that'll be kind of. I think they could potentially roll out a pretty fun starting lineup, right? With those four and someone. I don't know.
They're going to be fun.
Yeah, I mean, even like hell, put Dennis Smith with Luka and either Barea or Devin Harris and just go all out on the ball handling and passing. But it'll be fun. I think Dennis and Luka will play. I think they'll have some stuff to figure out. It's not going to be an easy, like, it clicks on day one kind of pairing. I think this would be hard even for two NBA veterans who are used to, I mean, obviously, I don't think it was too tough for Chris Paul and James Harden, apparently. But I think, generally speaking, it would be a difficult thing to figure out, and especially if you're so new into the league like either of these guys. There's too much talent there for it not to work.
Yep. Yeah, I think the Paul and Harden thing is definitely the outlier. But like the same concerns of like too many ball handlers, only one ball, probably does apply. And like Philly will have that with Simmons and Fultz this year as well. You could even say New Orleans with Alfred and Drew. Some of these guys are going to figure it out faster than others. And I think, if anything, I think it's going to help Dennis Smith to be able to play off the ball a little more just because he's so athletic. And they can use him more as a cutter. Like, you know, the same idea applied to Russ and Schroeder in OKC now, too. Just being able to, like, not be the focus of a defense every single possession should only help his efficiency improve. I mean, that was the big knock on him last year, is he shot only 39.5% overall. So I think that'll rise into the low to mid-40s, if not better. Yeah, I mean, the starting lineup question is really interesting because, you know, Dirk has already come out because, of course, he has and said he's like willing to play off the bench. And I think you're right. Like, I wouldn't play him in the starting five, I don't think, just because he was so much more effective at center last year than he was power forward. Like, he's 41. He just doesn't have the foot speed to keep up with these guys anymore. So I think you're right. It's like going to be like Smith, Doncic, Barnes at the four. And then, yeah, I probably put Wesley Matthews at the three.
Yeah.
I think that makes the most sense, especially because you've got a guy. And the one thing I'm not really caught up fully on is Luka's what kind of defensive impact we think Luka can make year one. I think you may run into some issues on defense. But, let's be honest here. The Mavericks were picking in the top five for a reason. And so it's not like we expect them to have all these gaps covered. And so as far as who they've got right now, I think that probably makes the most sense from to open the season as their starting five.
Yeah. This might be Dirk's last year, as mentioned. That said, you know, getting Luka, getting DeAndre Jordan in there, they did improve, like, more than, say, a Portland or a Sacramento. So do you think this team has a chance to compete for a playoff spot this year?
Yeah, I think there's a chance. I don't think it's necessarily realistic that it's going to end up that way, but I think there's a fighting chance. And if they solve their lineup conundrum and Luka turns out to be the guy that we're all expecting to and be that influential right off the bat, then why not?
Yeah.
I mean, I don't see why that couldn't happen if they could replace a team like Portland.
Yeah. I think they're going to be frisky. Like, I don't think they're going to make the playoffs, but I think they're going to be like 11th in the West, and they're going to be really annoying to play every night.
I could see that. I could totally see that. I could also see DeAndre just breaking out there just because of the, you know, change in scenery. Like, from all reports, he was, I don't want to say the word lazy, but he was just kind of stuck over the last couple of years in LA. Maybe this just lights a fire under his ass.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, like he was checked out mentally,
Yeah, he was because that, you know, that several people said that.
Right.
So if he comes in this year, it just... He's all in.
He's not under house arrest anymore, so he's actually a member of Dallas. So who knows?
He finally broke free. Yeah. Well, I mean, and he's got two good ball handlers now in Smith and Doncic. Like, Lob City died when Chris Paul left, so you're just, like, mitigating his effectiveness. Like, he's just a rim roller. He's not a unicorn. He is the opposite of a unicorn. If you don't have a good point guard to play with him and to, like, play pick and roll with him, he's not going to be good. But now they have Smith and Doncic, both of whom can fill that role, and even JJ Barea off the bench, Devin Harris off the bench, like,
even Harrison Barnes can do that on occasion.
Yeah, so, like, whenever he's on the floor, he's gonna have a pick and roll partner. I think you're right. Like, I expect DeAndre Jordan to have a bounce back here in Dallas. I know you were not wild about the signing, like, just the
I'm coming around.
Yeah, I mean, not like the contract, because it's 1 year, who cares, but just you weren't wild about, like, was that the best guy they should go after?
Yeah,
that's, you know, yeah. But I think as a stopgap, especially, you know, if this is Dirk's last year, if they're gonna have to, like, replace their entire front court next year, that's a good way to send him out. DeAndre Jordan's a fine 1 year fill-in, and I think this team's going to be more competitive than people expect, I think. Let's move on now to the Memphis Grizzlies. Since we already got the hype train rolling for one rookie, Mort, Jaren Jackson Jr. How excited are you to see him?
Well, honestly, I'm more excited about year two than year one, because I think he's so young. I think he was the youngest in the draft list, or at least the top five of the youngest?
I believe he was the youngest, yeah.
Yeah. And he's coming into a team where Marc Gasol and Mike Conley is very established. Mm-hmm. So he's going to get an opportunity to play, undoubtedly. And I think he's going to have those spurts where you just look at, where you can just see the potential is oozing off of him. And he's going to have one of those games where he just knocks down every three and blocks like five shots in like 20 minutes of play.
Yeah.
And you're just going to look at it and go, oh, look at that guy in 5 years. So, but yeah, I'm absolutely excited to get that first season out of the way so he can get more comfortable. And you, when year two rolls around, he's like, oh yeah, I got this. I got this. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, we'll get into it in a second, but Marc Gasol's future on the team is not set in stone. So he could be, this year I feel like he's just going to be in a smaller role because Gasol is there. But if Gasol leaves, whether he's traded or leaves as a free agent next summer, he could be then moving into like a 30, 35 minute per game role. It could be their starting center. Then he would join the unicorn party with like Porzingis and Embiid and Miles Turner and blah, blah, blah. Like he is that type of talent. So
we really need to get rid of the unicorn moniker because unicorns are, you know, supposed to be rare. Right. We have like a unicorn on
so
every team.
Many. Yeah.
Yeah.
Mace, Wart and I, we did an over-under pod, and one of the ones we felt most strongly about was Memphis. I think their over-under was like 34.5, which we just felt was way too low, assuming Mike Conley is healthy. Like, what? Now that he's back and assuming he stays healthy, people are really sleeping on this team, right? Like, they're going to be more competitive than a mid to or low to mid 30-win team.
Yeah, I think so. And obviously, that's the key cog is Conley's health. But also, I like the Kyle Anderson signing for them. I think, and we'll talk about it more in a second with the Spurs, but I think that coupled with what happened with the trade they made with Kawhi and Danny Green, I think that's a real problem for San Antonio. I think that, you know, if this team can stay healthy, you know, obviously the West is just so deep, keeps getting deeper every year, it seems like. But I think this team's got enough to be competitive. I mean, obviously with guys like Gasol and Conley, they're not young anymore, and so the fallback is coming. You could even argue it's already started to, but they've got top end talent. There's no question about that. And so I think if you're thinking about this team just through the lens of last season, I think that's not the right way to do it. And so yeah, I probably don't feel as strongly about the over as you guys, but I definitely do think if I had to pick one, I would pick over for Memphis.
Yeah. The only thing was, when I was looking back, was like they had, you know, last year they were awful, but like I think it was like each of the last 7 years they had at least 40 wins. And like, yeah, they lost Zebo, they lost Tony Allen, but like between Jaren Jackson and the other guys they added this offseason, again, it all depends on Conley's health. If he goes down again, they're going to be a sub 30 win team. But if he stays healthy, to me, they're similar to Dallas in that, like, I don't think they make the playoffs, but I think they're going to be very annoying to play every night.
Yeah.
Like they're going to be good.
I think it's tricky. It's kind of like the Minnesota Timberwolves over-under, right? Because, like, I think them, if you assume that Jimmy Butler's on the team all season, I think it's an easy over-pick for me. However,
right,
we don't know what's going to happen there. And I think the same is true for Memphis. It's not just Mike Conley. It's also, will they trade Marc Gasol, like you said. And so there's a bunch of what-ifs there that probably drove their over-under down a little bit. And so if we just look at it through the context of what's the team look like right now, yeah, I think it's an over. But there's probably too many unknowns there to feel super confident about it, in my opinion.
Agreed. Yeah. Yeah. I wouldn't go bet the house on Memphis, but if I had to bet, I would pick the over. But yeah, Mort, let's talk about Marc Gasol for a second, because as mentioned, he's a free agent next summer. If, you know, God forbid, if Conley goes down again, or if they just start off really slow, do you think they consider a Gasol trade?
They should. I mean, it's the same answer as I gave, you know, a week ago in terms of the Jimmy Butler question. Like, yeah, you should consider it. I mean, the worst thing an organization can go through is lose a major asset for nothing. It's just not good business. A lot of teams do it, and they end up going, oh, maybe we should have traded the guy while we still could. And Gasol, I mean, despite his age, still has very significant value. He's another unicorn because he can shoot the three, and he can pass from the low post, the high post. He can also initiate plays from outside the three-point line. He is a guy who can plug into virtually every system, and he will be a major asset. I mean, if there's a team out there that's looking to make a run at the finals, I could see them paying quite a lot for Marc Gasol, for the, even if it's just for a somewhat short time.
Yeah. The trick there is the same thing that we kind of saw with DeMarcus Cousins is like, Marc Gasol's a superior player to DeMarcus Cousins, but I think what we saw, the market for centers continued to dwindle. Cousins got frustrated and ended up taking the deal with Golden State. And I think the same logic kind of applies where how many teams really, really need a center, you know? And granted, Marc Gasol is an upgrade over most team centers, but it's a question of how much you're willing to pay for a rental of a guy who's playing a position that's kind of falling by the wayside a little bit, and also most teams feel like they're pretty set there. So I'll be very curious to see. And I agree, they should, if they're looking at missing the playoffs by a decent margin and want to move him at the deadline, I think they should absolutely consider it. But who's going to pay for him, and what are they going to pay?
Yeah, that's the good question. I mean, like, the Lakers strike me as a team that would be interested, but I just don't know how they make the contracts work. I guess you would have to include KCP and then probably one of Kuzma or Josh Hart, and I still don't even know. They might have to throw in a little bit of filler on top of that. But
San Antonio?
I mean, maybe. I get, who would they trade, though?
Yeah, that's I'm sitting here thinking, I mean, they would have to sacrifice some of the young guys, but they can't really afford to do that, I think. But, I mean, I don't know. They went all in on DeRozan.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, he would be a great fit there. I guess Pau is earning enough where you probably could just flip him with, like, one of Walker or Murray and do it.
Yeah, I mean, I personally wouldn't. I wouldn't do it, but I could just see, like, their logic could be that, going, right. Oh, you know what? We have DeMar. He's 29, I want to say. So maybe get something and see if we can make a final run before we blow everything to hell.
Yeah. Or I could see, like, the Heat maybe just trying to dump Whiteside and, like, send a pick out.
Oh, interesting.
With that to get Gasol as well. But it's a fair question. You're right, Mason. Like, there is not a huge market. Like, most teams are pretty set at center or will not pay what the Grizzlies want for him. So that will complicate things. You did mention Kyle Anderson already. I also just, like, they had a low-key, really good summer. Like, getting Jaren Jackson at 4 was just amazing. Like, Mort and I both had him as the second-best prospect in this draft. Kyle Anderson, they might have paid him a little more than they should have, but, like, he's going to be a good fit there. If nothing else, they don't have to rely on Chandler Parsons as much, which is a win in and of itself. And also, like, getting Garrett Temple, Omri Caspi, like, this
Javon
team
Carter.
This team has a bench again, right?
Yeah, I totally agree. I think they're kind of got back to the grit and grind Grizzlies, right? I don't know where the offense is going to come from, but but defensively they're long and they're talented, and so I think they're going to be the typical Grizzlies that we've come to know. They're going to be pests and going to be except when Chandler Parsons is in,
which he's not going to be. He's going to play 10 games and he's going to get off for the year again. Let's finish things up now with the San Antonio Spurs. Obviously, the big storyline of the summer for them was the Kawhi Leonard trade. So, since he's gone, DeMar DeRozan is in. He is now the big storyline for them this season. Mort, do you think a career year is ahead for him with him under Popovich?
No, not this year, next year. Because, as Richard Jefferson said once, it takes about a year to understand San Antonio's system. It's not something you just enter into. It takes a while to gain that level of trust that's needed within the boundaries of the offense. And it just takes some time to get acquainted to that and to get acclimated to that system and to Pop, because he is a special character on the sideline. So I think that is going to prove true for DeRozan as well, especially because he's so high volume. Next year, I think, could be a career year.
That's interesting. I've just read, like, too many hype pieces, I guess, about DeRozan.
Oh, yeah.
Just talking about, like, how pissed off he is about the trade and, like...
Like, he's going to be good.
Yeah. Yeah. I guess career year is probably ambitious, but...
Because wasn't last year a career year for him?
Yeah. 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 I mean, that's the thing. I'm just excited to see him under Pop. Like, maybe in terms of, like, points per game production, he won't... he might not, like, his... career high was 27.3 in 2016-17. I don't know that he goes there again, but it wouldn't surprise me at all. Last year, he set a career high in assists with 5.2. I wouldn't be surprised if he goes even higher this year under Pop.
Yeah.
Like, I'm just excited to see the ways in which Pop deploys him, because I think it's going to be different. It's going to, like, reinvent what we expect from DeMar DeRozan, if that makes sense.
I think it does. I think it does. He's probably going to be, I mean, maybe even the primary playmaker over Murray, even.
Mm-hmm.
That wouldn't surprise me at all. It all depends on how he reads the offense and how he reads his teammates. And I mean, again, it's feasible that he has a career year with the Spurs in his first one. I don't know. I'm just saying, like, the offense isn't, you know, it's not or it's not Houston. Just, hey, just remember to take a shot before the shot clock hits 20.
Right.
You know, it's there's a little bit more intricacy into it. So, I'm interested in seeing DeRozan in San Antonio. And also, I'm kind of annoyed, though, at you know, the whole hating aspect of, oh, it's all going to be mid-range jump shots. Like, yeah, there is going to be a lot of it, granted. But they're going to be of high value. It's going to be a highly, you know, high percentage mid-range shots. And there is a difference between a contested mid-ranger and an open mid-range shot. Right. And people just have begun, because of this new era of three ball and all, people are just like, every mid-range shot is bad. Like,
yeah.
No, there are nuances to it. Like, an open mid-range shot can be a good shot. Like, don't overthink this. Yeah. And San Antonio are just so damn good at just finding these open mid-rangers. So I think that would just do him so good.
Especially if your two best players, like, they are known for being able to hit those shots consistently in DeMar DeRozan and LaMarcus Aldridge. Like, yeah, it's aesthetically, it's not going to be the most beautiful style of basketball. It's not going to be like it's not going to be like the 2014 Spurs or like the Warriors from the past couple of years. But I mean, I think it's still going to be like the Spurs are just in general, they're going to be better. They're another team where it's like, the Vegas over-under was too low on them. And I'm seeing, like, some people are predicting them to miss the playoffs. The Spurs are not going to miss the playoffs.
I'm one of them.
Oh, you are?
I am.
Really?
Yeah.
I want to hear this.
Well, so let me preface this by saying that I think Greg Popovich is a genius and the best coach of all time. That said, I don't know where the defense is going to come from. I know DeJounte Murray is great. No arguments there. However, that's where it ends for me. I know Pop has this habit of pulling defense and things like that out of thin air and getting the most out of his guys, and I get that. But I just think they lost so much on the wing as far as defense is concerned. And given how good the conference is this year, I have them 9. Like, I have them ahead of Portland. And if they make the playoffs, it obviously would not shock me at all. But as of right now, I have them as the 9th seed and missing, because I just don't know where the defense, apart from DeJounte Murray and in the backcourt, is going to come from. And I don't think they're going to score at a rate that's high enough to overcome them.
It's interesting. Yeah, I mean, I get, like, Kawhi only played 9 games, so I'm not really, like, factoring him into last year's defense. But that said, Danny Green is a huge loss for them. Like, that, I totally agree, that flies under the radar when we're talking about both, like, what Toronto gained and what San Antonio lost. Because, like, yes, he was a streaky shooter, but he was a very good defender.
Right.
And as you mentioned, Kyle Anderson as well. But it's, yeah, like, this might just be me thinking Popovich is an absolute wizard and, like...
Which is fine. There's nothing wrong with
it. I have long passed the days where I could doubt Pop. Like, he turned Pau Gasol into a half-decent defender.
I'm so ready for Dante Cunningham, Pelicans cast-off, to become this major piece for them and me just being super frustrated.
I'm just saying, like, Rudy Gay has now come out and said, like, he feels healthy and athletic again. Yep. I could see him having, you know, he's now a year and a half removed, I think, from the Achilles tear. So, he could be much better than he was last year as well.
And the addition of Lonnie Walker, you're getting some much-needed explosivity and athleticism into that team. I mean, granted, an NBA defense is not, you know, for most rookies, that's a challenge. But I think it's going to be a challenging for him as well. But his physical profile will have him be able to cover a lot of bases. And I also think Jakob Poeltl, at least at the rim, will provide some defensive context. I agree with your overall point, though, Mace, that, you know, that defense is, that took a step down. Like, you don't have that difference maker. You don't have that sole guy like Danny Green who can just go in and, like, switch and be a terror on the ball. But I think collectively there is at least a chance that Pop will find the guys that work out and have them increase like collectively enough up to the point where it's a playoff team. But I mean, you could easily be right about this, and they could be an absolute train wreck defensively. I think, you know, going back to Dejounte Murray, like if he becomes this all defensive type guy, like then maybe he overtakes Danny Green's role in that sense, like from a defensive perspective.
Yep.
But yeah, I don't know. It's at least worth thinking about. Like I agree that they're defensively they might be a step slow.
Yeah, I think if you put that lineup on any other team that's not coached by Pop or maybe even like Brad Stevens, for example, like
I
think that's a bottom five defense in the NBA. So that's my concern. And again, Pop has worked wonders before. This wouldn't be outside of the norm for him. But I struggle. And even Dejounte Murray, like he played like 15 to 20 minutes a game last year. And which is, I feel like not many people have talked about that. I did because people were trying to tell me he was better than Jrue Holiday on defense, and I was telling people to pump the brakes on that one because Jrue Holiday was playing twice as many minutes as him. But he's got to be able to do it for, and I think he can. I mean, he's very talented on the defensive end, but they're going to ask him to play way more minutes this year than he played last year. Mm-hmm. And so, how does he react to that? And he, especially when you consider that he's going to be the defensive anchor on the perimeter for them. So a lot of questions there.
Yeah, I agree.
That's a fair point. You guys are forgetting that Marco Bellinelli is going to turn into the second coming of Kawhi Leonard. So
Marco, just... Quincy Pondexter, Dante Cunningham, the roster's full of New Orleans cast-offs.
Stellar defenders and New Orleans cast-offs all the same.
Yeah.
The last question for the Spurs before we go. LaMarcus Aldridge had a career, well, not a career year, but like his best year in San Antonio last year. That comes after... He had the whole like meltdown in the Western Conference Finals. Pop called him out, said he was timid. He demanded a trade. They had that face-to-face, and we will like hash things out and figure out how best to use him. Mace, do you think he's going to take a step back this year now that he has to share touches with DeMar DeRozan? Like, do you think the year he had last year was a product of him being able to go back to being that number one option? So now that he's splitting touches with another high-usage guy, he's going to decline a bit? Or do you think that, you know, that preseason face-to-face just like solved all their issues and he's just gonna be good for them for, you know, in perpetuity because he's Pop?
I'm not concerned on it from like any sort of personality disagreements or anything like that. I'm more concerned that you're adding a dynamic ball dominant player into that that very much team mentality in San Antonio, and like Mort said, I think it probably takes a year for it to fully gel, but I have every bit of confidence that it can. But also, and I feel like I've kind of harped on this decent amount throughout the pod, LaMarcus Aldridge is 33 years old, and I feel like at some point his game isn't one that's going to be super impacted by age. What he does well doesn't heavily rely too heavily on athleticism, but I still think, you know, at some point, you're like I said about Gasol, you're going to start, or even Conley, you're going to start thinking about taking steps back because, you know, you've just put so many minutes and miles on your body. And so I think it's going to be tough, a little tough sledding at the start for the DeRozan reason, and also just because I think, as players age, they just tend to decline a little bit.
Yeah, that's a fair point. Mort, any final thoughts on Aldridge or the Spurs before we go?
Well, I think Aldridge... And DeRozan specifically, I think they're going to pair well and probably a little bit better than most fans believe because of all the mid-range hoopla. It seems that LaMarcus is so great at actually playing off of others as well that I think it's going to be so almost an asset for him to get a guy like DeRozan whose defense is just keying on. Like when he goes into like the mid-post or, you know, in the elbow area, like teams just turn their heads so much to see, oh, where is he going with this? Because he can pass, like he'll find the open corner shooter on the opposite on the weak side. So I think Aldridge is just going to use that attention that he's going to demand, that DeRozan is going to demand, and just feed off of that a bunch. For some reason, he didn't do it with Kawhi because, you know, he was at odds with Pop and like the whole chemistry thing was just off. But now that he's sort of had his kumbaya moment with Pop, I think he's more inclined to be open-minded about it. And when, you know, DeRozan comes in and Aldridge has just had the year that he's had where he averaged, what, 23, I want to say? I just think he's more ready now to play off of a strong perimeter player. I have a feeling they're going to be really good together.
Yeah. I'm excited to see it. Well, that's going to wrap things up for us this episode. Mason, thanks again for joining us. Just remind our listeners one more time where they can find your Twitter and where they can find your work.
Sure, yep. Yeah. So, again, for Bourbon Street Shots, you can find any of our work there, bourbonstreetshots.com. My Twitter handle is just my name, and then Bourbon Street Shots is site's name with street abbreviated.
Great, yeah. Give Mason a follow. It's going to be a lot of Anthony Davis hype this year. We should all be excited for that. In the meantime, follow us on Twitter at the NBA Pod. You can find our Twitter handles in our bio, so give us a follow as well. You can also find us on iTunes, so please subscribe, download, leave some 5-star reviews. We'd love any feedback. And we're being hosted on the Almighty Baller Podcast Network, so check them out on Twitter at Almighty Casts. Until next time, I'm Brian Toporek, and I was joined by Morten Jensen and Mason Ginsburg. Have a good one, guys.
You too, Brian.